Welcome to the podcast. I'm Dr. Val Jones, founder of GetBetterHealth.com. Today I'll be speaking with Dr. Victor Burnett about thyroid disease. Dr. Burnett is the Assistant Chief of the Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism Service at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Dr. Burnett, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you, Val. It's very nice to be here and have a chance to talk with you.
So to get started, let's have your disclaimer.
Just want to make clear, as I'm a DOD employee, that the views that I'm about to share with you are my own and don't represent any official DOD policies or views. So
understood.
We have that out of the way.
Understood. Okay. So to begin, I wanted to ask you this first question. It's estimated that more than 25 million Americans have thyroid disease, and as many as half of the people with thyroid problems don't even know it. In your view, what are the main reasons why so many thyroid disorders go undiagnosed?
Well, that's a good question, and there's going to be several points to my answer. I think one thing is to point out, when we talk about 25 million Americans having thyroid disease, that could encompass, from what I know, being hypothyroid or hyperthyroid, which may or may not have symptoms if you're subclinical, meaning that the excess or deficiency of thyroid hormone is very mild, one might not have a whole lot of symptoms with it. The other thing is that probably that number encompasses thyroid nodules and thyroid cancer, which many times have no symptoms whatsoever, just may be an enlargement which you may or may not even notice, and many times is incidentally found, like on a CT scan of the neck or maybe a carotid duplex ultrasound or some study where the thyroid is incidentally imaged and the nodules are noted. I think the other issue is that there's no formal screening going on, recommendations for hypo and hyperthyroidism in the U.S. Some of that's based on the fact that the U.S. Preventive Task Force, while it found that you can use TSH potentially to screen people for thyroid dysfunction, that they can't really prove, even doing targeted screening, that you actually improve outcomes in patients. And so that hasn't really been pushed in any way, although many members of like the ATA, American Thyroid Association, and ACP probably believe that we should at least screen certain subgroups, maybe pregnant women, patients with like Down syndrome or Klinefelter's that have an increased risk or family history of Hashimoto's and such. I think the other thing to mention is that the symptoms of like hypo or hyperthyroidism can be developed very gradually, and sometimes they occur more frequently, like hypothyroidism, in an older population, and they may be attributed by the patient or the physician to just normal symptoms of aging or signs of aging. And so that, I think, plays a role as well while we patients go undiagnosed.
Now, you know, in medical school, they teach us to check the thyroid gland on the physical exam. And I wonder if you think that self-exams or exams by physicians are likely to turn up something clinically relevant. Is it difficult to really feel those nodules?
Yes, it can be. And there's a nice, when I give lectures about this, there's a very nice graph that was published by Dr. Ernie Mazzaferri that shows that when you go by palpation, and this would be in about patients 50 to 60 years of age, there's about an 8% chance of palpating a thyroid nodule. When you progress to using thyroid ultrasound, you will find that the rate is much higher, and it comes out to about an average of the patient's age minus 15. So, ergo, if you're 60 years old, there's about a 45% of having chance of having a thyroid nodule, and so ultrasound is much more sensitive. A part of the concern, though, is that many of those nodules are not clinically relevant or going to cause a patient harm, and so then no one has come out and recommended we should be doing thyroid ultrasounds on everyone to find thyroid nodules per se. Having said that, self-exam, which is promoted by the Association of American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, or ACE, in their handouts that they provide to their members who are to give out to patients, they talk about doing a self-exam. And again, you may have a patient who notes the thyroid is somewhat enlarged. It's interesting to me, if those physicians are giving out that handout, though, I would think that they would be examining the patient's thyroid already. But we do give those kind of handouts out, and you may find something, but it hasn't been proven that we find it at an earlier stage or, again, that we impact any outcomes. It seems to be a simple enough procedure that why not do it, because it has a low downside. But, you know, patients may feel things incorrectly. We even have primary care doctors who sometimes mistake some of the cartilage for a nodule, and the patient's concerned there's a nodule there when there isn't. And I don't want to draw too much of a direct comparison because I know it's been somewhat controversial in the news, but as you probably are aware, they announced that they're not necessarily recommending breast self-exam because they didn't find that it made an impact in the outcomes with patients. And that's my question. We can recommend this. It's probably low, a low downside to harming the patient in any way, other than maybe it leads to an unnecessary evaluation if they think they feel something when there's nothing there. But it's just not clear how we benefit the patients with it.
Mm. Do you think there's a difference in terms of patient discomfort between a biopsy of the thyroid versus the breast?
That's a good question. With the biopsy of the thyroid, we don't typically use lidocaine and such. And the reasoning is the following. We use very small 27, some people use 25 gauge needles. And you can numb the skin, but the skin prick from the needle is not what bothers the patient. They get a pressure sensation when you go in with the needle. And you can use a large amount of lidocaine and not get rid of that pressure sensation. So most patients do very well with a thyroid biopsy, but they do get a little bit of that discomfort. Where my experience with breast biopsies is they use lidocaine successfully and are able to numb up the area pretty well, and people don't feel it. But as again, I counsel my patients I'm doing biopsies, and I tell them that the vast majority will tell me after we're done that it wasn't something they would have gotten worried about if they would have known that's all it was, and the anticipation was much worse than the actual procedure per se.
There seems to be some controversy regarding how to diagnose hypothyroidism, and some say that TSH is sufficient. Others also check free T3 and T4, and others may have different ideas about TSH levels required for a diagnosis of hypothyroidism. What does the current evidence suggest about how doctors should perform and interpret thyroid tests?
Okay. I think I'll have to answer this in a couple of stages. One, just about using TSH, and then I'll get into what the potential goals for TSH might be. TSH is a great screening tool, and, of course, the definition of screening is you really get an asymptomatic population, and you say, 60-year-old women and older have a 5 to 10% chance of hypothyroidism, and they may not have symptoms from that, so we don't want to miss it. We'll draw a TSH, and then if that's abnormal, we'll follow up with a free T4 level. And so that's really, TSH is 100 times more sensitive than T4 and is the best thing for screening. What is misunderstood, I think, and many people coming out of med school seem to misunderstand this, is that that's screening. When you have somebody who has symptoms of hypothyroidism or has a high risk, again, they have strong family history of Hashimoto's, or maybe they have thyroid autoantibodies themselves, TPO and TG, they're at an increased risk. And then you're doing case finding or diagnosing, and then I would advocate getting a free T4 level along with your TSH. It's not that expensive, and I think it adds something. It allows you to not miss the more infrequent case of central hypothyroidism where the TSH may not be reliable, but that being the infrequent patient. As far as T3 levels, T3 levels are primarily conserved and hypothyroidism to the bitter end. And so they're not very helpful in the management of hypothyroidism. Hyperthyroidism in Graves' patients, we use it, but not any good evidence to show that T3 really enhances the diagnosis of a hypothyroid patient. Now, as far as your question about what TSH goal, well, I think a little history is worth providing here. TSH normal ranges usually go about 0.45 or 0.5. I see one assay may go down to 0.27, up to about 4.5 or 5. And again, it's a whole, you spend several hours talking about the whole history, but the gist is that was used for many years, and it was even advocated that maybe TSH levels of 6 or 7 might be actually normal, realizing that the normal range only accounts for about 95% of patients, and about 2.5% of patients will be below or above the 2 standard deviation bell curve that we use. So the TSH goal was many years just used as that 0.5 to 5 range or thereabouts. Then the NHANES data came out where they've been sampling people within the United States at various time points over the last decade and a half and looking at their thyroid blood test, and realized that when you look that a majority of people's blood tests fall, a TSH fall in between 0.5 to 2.5 or thereabouts. And so it's felt that there may be a more narrow window for TSH to be normal. That being said, there's also some data to say that TSH may go higher as one gets older, and that may be a normal phenomenon. And it's not well quantified or qualified at this point in time. The NHANES data also would indicate, and some other data, that there may be some racial differences with African Americans having a little bit lower TSH levels than Caucasians. So it all makes it very confusing because you say, well, patients that have no history of any family disease of thyroid disease, family history of thyroid disease, I'm sorry, or any presence of thyroid antibodies in their bloodstream tend to have a TSH of, again, 0.5 to 2.5 or 3. And when you go back, some of the older normal ranges, they didn't really rule out patients for family history or antibodies. And so many advocate, again, the tighter TSH levels. So the problem is, I think, is there's not necessarily proof that making that more narrow window actually translates into reduced complications from patients if they had untreated subclinical hypothyroidism. And I think there's still some concern that we have to be very careful about using that narrow therapeutic TSH level to diagnose people. Once we've diagnosed people, I think there's much more agreement in the thyroid community that making sure that people's TSHs stay in that narrow therapeutic window of about 0.5 to 3 or 2.5, depending on who you talk to.
Well, switching gears now to a primary care question. Many patients often come to their primary care physician after having gained some weight, and they say, I'm concerned that it's my thyroid. At what point do you think it's important to test their thyroid function?
And that's a good question. That's a very common question that we run into. And as far as having testing for thyroid, it's definitely easy to do. I think a screening TSH is definitely worthwhile doing. One may add a free T4 if they think there's a reason to worry. There may be secondary hypothyroidism and such. My understanding, listening to obesity experts who run clinics and do screening, that the vast majority of people that are overweight or have obesity do not end up having a definable endocrine abnormality such as hypothyroidism. That being said, we definitely know that people with hypothyroidism have potential weight gain. And so I usually try to look and see if they have other symptoms of hypothyroidism, realizing that many of those symptoms are nonspecific. But if I have a patient who's overweight and also describes to me a problem with constipation and dry skin, I'm much more likely to do the screening. And in reality, if, you know, the weight issue is really of a concern to the patient, I don't think it's unreasonable to go ahead and get a TSH level plus minus a free T4 to go ahead and screen them for that. But at some point in time when that's normal, then we have to look for other more common causes.
Absolutely. Tell me a little bit about the most popular, quote-unquote, alternative medicine for thyroid disease and the evidence, if there is any, for their use.
Okay. There's been a lot on this, both in the lay press and there have been studies. I'll tackle, I think, T3 first. So we know that the thyroid primarily makes T4 and just a little bit of T3 directly. And then most T3, which is the active thyroid hormone that really controls metabolism and does the main things that thyroid hormone does in the body, comes from peripheral conversion of T4 to T3. So when Synthroid, or I should say levothyroxine, and those products came out, it was known that that's primarily T4. And so there was some concern later saying, well, that little bit of T3 that you would normally get isn't there. Now, some more recent data by Dr. Jonklis et al. Showed actually they tested patients who were about to have their thyroid removed for various reasons, and they got thyroid blood tests, including a T3 level before surgery, and then after surgery being on one of the T4 levothyroxine products, and found that the patient's T3 levels were the same when they were dependent on endogenous production from their thyroid, and then they did not have symptoms of hypothyroidism, and afterwards. So would give indication that there is appropriate conversion of T4 to T3 when we give thyroid hormone. And actually, there's even some other data I've seen that shows that there is some T3 found in the T4 when we give it in small amounts. So, but that's probably the standard therapy, and the majority of people do fine on that. In 1999, there was some renewed interest in Cytomel, which is T3, because there's a subset of patients who are hypothyroid who just feel they don't feel well or the same as they did prior to their thyroidectomy. Some of them may have been thyroid cancer patients. Some of them may have just been, or not even necessarily thyroidectomy. They may have been hypothyroid patients who had hash and then went on to be put on thyroid hormone. And so Dr. Bunavish just got a combination of patients who had had thyroidectomies or had Hashimoto's hypothyroidism or atrophic hypothyroidism and put them on combination T4, T3, and initially showed some subtle benefits with visual, spatial performance and such, and seemed to indicate that people might benefit from having a combination of T4 and T3. However, numerous articles have been come out since then, and many of them tackled some of the deficiencies with the Bunavicious article, trying to standardize how much T4 and T3 people receive by weight and the ratio of T4 and T3 and such. And with 11 articles and a 2006 meta-analysis, there was no evidence that we could show that there's a distinct benefit to having people on combination T4, T3. That being said, I will tell you, when the Bunavicious article came out in 99, many of us, including myself, did try T3, T4 combinations. And what I found in my patients was that they initially seemed to feel better for a month or two after we had started the combination, and then about 3 or 4 months out felt that they weren't doing well again and wanted to increase the dose, yet despite the fact that their TSH many times was suppressed, that meaning that the brain was saying there was too much thyroid hormone, and so it would indicate to me that they maybe got a transient or placebo-type benefit from the combination but couldn't show that there was an actual prolonged benefit, which is what you really want. The other things that are available, there's good old armor thyroid, which is basically desiccated animal thyroid. Some patients have been on that for many, many years. Sometimes it's very difficult to convince them that you think they'd be better on one of the synthetic T4 preparations, which is more pure. And the problem with armor thyroid in my mind is, in many people's mind, is that they're from batch to batch, you don't know how much T4 to T3 you're getting. And so some batches have more T3 than others, and those levels can pop up and actually give people adverse symptoms, palpitations, nervousness, and such. And when you measure levels of T4 and T3 after armor, they're not consistent with what you would consider the typical type thyroid hormone levels in a euthyroid patient, because the T3 levels many times are above the reference range right after you take the medication for several hours, and then by the time the next dose is due, the T3 levels are a lot lower than one would expect in a normal patient, and the T4 levels tend to run lower across the board. Let's see what else is there. And then I guess you had asked in your one of your questions about the thyroid diet and such things. I don't think we know of any evidence to say that any particular diet helps thyroid function. Of course, we know chronic insufficiency of iodine in the diet is not good, and then people get goiters and cretinism in third world countries where there's extreme iodine deficiency. But in the United States, where iodine intake seems to be fairly adequate, we don't see any benefit in adding extra iodine or selenium or such things at this point in time.
And have you heard of people recommending other alternatives regularly to actually taking some Synthroid or some Armour?
When you say other people, what do you mean?
Physicians or just patients, or you know, if there's a trend in online nutraceuticals or something that I don't know of that you
yeah.
know about, because
I mean.
Patients keep coming to you and saying, hey, doc, yeah. did I take this, you know?
There was a back in the mid-90s, I was actually called by a primary care doctor who was talking to me about Wilson syndrome. And initially, I was a little bit confused because I thought they were calling about Wilson's disease, and I wasn't sure why they weren't talking to the gastroenterologist. And then it came forth that, no, there's this website called Wilson syndrome, and it explained these patients who had fairly normal thyroid function tests, although their T3 might be a little bit on the lower side of normal. And it was postulated on that website by the people that ran it that people needed some T3 transiently because for whatever reason the deiodinase that converts T4 to T3 might not be working correctly. There's been a lot come from that website and other sites postulating that, but no real good evidence-based proof that that occurs. And again, there's so much evidence now showing that the mixture T4, T3 combos don't really benefit the patient. So I do have patients come in and read various things on the internet. Sometimes I still hear people coming from the Wilsons or other organizations. And we talk about what the what all the information is and the facts are about T3 and what the levels look like on when you're on T3 products versus a straight T4 product, and try to educate the patient on it. And my preference is for them to be on a T4 product because I think they do better. On occasion, I inherit patients who are already on a combination, and if they're doing well and their hormone levels are appropriate, their TSH does not become suppressed, and they're doing well, I might be willing to allow them to remain on it, but it's not my preference for initially starting someone. And I typically see that the thyroid blood tests aren't quite where we want them by and large. Not always. I mean, I do have some patients who still remain on a combo therapy and are doing well.
Have you had any patients come to you who have sort of self-diagnosed hypothyroidism in themselves through research online?
Sure. We definitely have patients who read about symptoms or hear symptoms from friends or family and say, hey, I have those symptoms, and they go get tested. Or maybe they have a parent who just got tested and was told they have Hashimoto's, and I always tell my patients that they have autoimmune disease, they should let their family, direct family members know, so they may be at a higher risk and such. And so we definitely have people come in and self-refer and say, my mom has hash and I know I need to be checked every once in a while. The issue comes down to that the symptoms of hypothyroidism are many times nonspecific. And some symptoms like weight gain and fatigue, both of which one can see with hypothyroidism, are very prevalent in general. And people want to ascribe it to thyroid problems or other things. And then, not to sound like somebody's mother, but a lot of times I talk to them, well, what's your sleep habit, what's your exercise habit, what's your diet? And they have totally normal thyroid function tests, still want to blame their symptoms on that. And I say, you know what, I think we've checked that, that's normal, and we need to look for other causes. And a lot of times, you know, people are trying to get by on 6 hours of sleep, and they don't exercise regularly, and their diet is a lot of junk food. And I would say, you know, maybe we should go back to addressing those things before trying to pinpoint the thyroid. By the same token, there are people that have real thyroid disease. I had one patient I inherited one time who had a TSH of almost 200 and had abnormal cholesterol when it had been fairly reasonable several years before. And we figured out he was just hypothyroid, got him on treatment, and he felt tremendously better.
Mm. I know that it's really miraculous how much better people feel when they do have true hypothyroidism and you fix that through medical therapy. I know that it really does wonders to people. What advice do you have for patients with hypothyroidism? Sometimes I've heard them say, when I first went on Synthroid, I felt so much better, but it's really just not doing it for me anymore. Do you get that complaint too, and what do you tell them?
Yeah, we get complaints that they're on, levothyroxine type preparation, or they may even be on the combo, and they come in and they say, I don't feel as well. And again, as I just mentioned, I look at the practical things and see what's going on in their lives as far as, stressors and that such, and diet and exercise. We also, of course, make sure we know what their most recent thyroid function tests are and that they seem to have an appropriate TSH. Again, I would probably try, if I have someone in therapy, keep their TSH about 0.5 to 2.5 or thereabouts. If they're a little bit older, I might allow it to be a little bit on the higher side because, again, there's some data that may be more appropriate. Thyroid cancer patients are different. We sometimes try to keep their TSHs lower. And then I talk to them, make sure that they understand that they need to take the thyroid hormone regularly. We do have run into issues where patients sometimes forget, and that can make it harder to have a nice, smooth thyroid hormone profile. We talk about things that interfere with the action or absorption of thyroid hormone. Common things like calcium and iron will bind thyroid hormone in the gut. Some of the PPI inhibitors and such will impact absorption of thyroid hormone. And so those are things that we always make the patients aware of. Or if they've been stable and suddenly have abnormal thyroid functions after being stable on thyroid hormone, we try to figure out what the cause is. And we don't always just adjust the medication. Sometimes I figured out, they started taking calcium with their thyroid hormone. Well, we have them take their thyroid hormone an hour before, 2 to 3 hours after, and then their thyroid hormone has become normalized. And again, we talk about it takes 4 to 6 weeks for a thyroid hormone to hit its target range after starting therapy or making a change in dose. And so the need to do blood tests after that time period and every so often based on what your physician feels is most appropriate interval for you. The other thing I mentioned and alluded to was patients who have Hashimoto's. They do have a slight increased risk of other autoimmune diseases, and so we talk about risk for family members. We also talk within them that they might be at a slightly increased risk have an increased risk, although small, absolute risk for getting type 1 diabetes and other autoimmune disease, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and so forth, adrenal insufficiency. The vast majority won't get that, but I like them to know that that's a concern.
Excellent point. And to wrap up, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about the relationship of the primary care physician with the endocrinologist. Mm-hmm. when should a primary care physician refer a thyroid patient to an endocrinologist, do you think?
Well, I definitely think a lot of hypothyroid patients can be managed very well by a primary care provider. And just from healthcare dynamics, we know there are only so many endocrinologists, and so the primary care does need to assume some of the burden of the patient care for these patients. I think if a primary care doctor notes that the blood tests seem to be somewhat atypical, and don't fit a regular pattern, it'd be great for them to send us our way. I think if a patient's refractory to treatment, they have thyroid function tests that are all over the board, or their symptoms don't seem to get better, or they seem to track how they normally should, we should see them. If they note that they have anatomical abnormalities like thyroid nodules or masses, that's something that I think it's helpful to at least have us see them and give an opinion if they need to see us regularly or can go back and just be followed by primary care. Many times with nodules, we're going to want to follow them long-term and potentially do biopsies and such. Always prefer the primary care has a specific question that they have in mind, what we're trying to help them answer. And some people are more comfortable with certain diagnoses than others, and if a particular primary care feels less comfortable with interpreting the thyroid function tests, and that's something where, I think they think the patient would benefit us seeing. We're happy to see them at least one time, and we can always give specific recommendations so that they can follow them up long-term.
Is there anything that you wish referring PCPs would do more frequently before referring patients to you?
Sure. I think one good thing to do is to maybe wait a couple of weeks after you have some mildly abnormal thyroid function tests and repeat them to make sure it's something that's consistent. Sometimes people have just been ill or, you know, there's a lab variation or such, and so it's good to know that the lab tests are a consistent finding. I think if they've shown a couple of elevated TSH levels that, and or there's a family history of autoimmune thyroid disease, that getting a TPO-TG thyroid antibody panel is a worthwhile thing. I also, and alluding back to the patient I mentioned with the cholesterol, I think if a primary care finds a patient with an abnormal thyroid hormone level, we like to know what a CBC is and a Chem-20 and a lipid panel. So, because those all can potentially be impacted by hypothyroidism depending on how severe it is. And so just remembering their good primary care kind of care things are important.
Hmm. And in closing then, I wonder, how do you find that right balance between managing a patient with a challenging thyroid problem along with the primary care physician? Do you have any suggestions for that? You know, at what point do you hand them off to the primary care physician? At what point do you both have your hands in the pot? You know, and that's,
yeah,
you know, confusing for the patient.
Well, I think communication is key. I think there should be one cook in the kitchen when you're trying to really negotiate changes in thyroid function tests and you're trying to adjust the dose. Because if you have two of you making changes, it can be very discombobulating, and you really need to go ahead and give a dosage change and wait 4 to 6 weeks and such. So usually I'll tell my patients, and I'll say, you know, at this point in time, I'd rather for the next, you know, 6 or 12 weeks that I kind of manage the thyroid hormone dosing, and if your primary care has any questions, we'll be glad to communicate them in whatever form they find best, phone or email if appropriate, if it's set up and such. And so go that route and let them know what our goal is. And I think that's the other job of an endocrinologist is, or a thyroidologist, is to make clear what our TSH goal is and the things that we're thinking about and explaining why, you know, that we made the changes that we did. And, you know, older patient, we want to go slow with rising the dose and such. And I think, and we give lectures, as you know, somebody who's in academics, we like to communicate with our primary care doctors and let them know kind of what the standard, you know, the art of therapy is and such at this point in time. And I think that's another way we work together. But at some point in time, the patient's been stable for several months, or several checks on their thyroid function test, I think it's very appropriate for primary care to take them back over. And, you know, if things develop, problems in the future where the thyroid function tests are off again, or the patient doesn't feel quite right, or now they suddenly have a goiter where they didn't, or a nodule, then they can always send them back to us to be evaluated.
You've been listening to a podcast interview with Dr. Victor Burnett. I'm Dr. Val Jones, founder of GetBetterHealth.com.